Hi, Josh.
Hey, Dana.
Welcome to Think Visual Shapeshifters. And
thanks
for joining me today.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Well, I think it would be great to start with who you are and what you do today and how you got here.
Oh, thanks. You already know me, maybe the people watching. I'm Josh, and I'm the head of product at a small fintech called PaidRight. This is my first product role. Before that, I've been product designer. I started and I got out of high school and went into a technical degree. I was studying computer science and game development and multimedia. Lasted about a year in game development and multimedia, and I found it really boring. And then part of the game development multimedia was a design subject, and we had to do it, and I did it. And that's where it was a light bulb moment for me that, design isn't just pure creativity and subjectivity. Design has rules and patterns, and you use those rules and patterns. And I was like, oh, I can do this. Like, I liked it. I found it, you know, very logical. And that's why I changed. I said, I'll change to graphic design. And then when I did graphic design, that's what you're referring to. There was a bunch of people that were very different to me. They had all done arts in high school, and they were creative, and they wanted to experiment with this and that. And I wanted to understand the rules of design. Like, I was the only person that did any major work in websites. Everyone else did branding and packaging. I was the only person that I think had done like 3-unit math at high school. They all hated math, and they all liked literature and art. And so there was this big divide, and I saw that in one way as a stark contrast, but also as a bit of a superpower, because I really liked the logic behind it. And so I went straight into digital and web design technology and just applying these rules to how you convert sites, how you understand user needs. And it was very logical. And so it was a lot of fun. And then when you start building websites for small businesses and you're charging a couple hundred dollars and you want to go, how do I charge a few more hundred dollars or $1,000? Then you have to justify why you do the design, right? It's not just, oh, it's a nice design, but the design needs to work. And so then when the design needed to work, I went into like UX, and you had to do research and you had to understand what its purpose was. And so we went from there, and all of a sudden I'm a UX designer. And then when you're a UX designer and you're shouting out loud about, we need to do this, and someone tells you, oh, well, we can't do that because of X, Y, Z, you realize good design is not only good product is not only understanding what the user needs, but understanding what the business needs. And so that's kind of the really short version of how I got into the product space rather than just design or just web, was understanding customer problems that work for the business and solving them. And so that's where I am today. I'm a head of product at this small fintech in Sydney. Previously, I was at a booking platform called Resdy. And then before that, I was at Domain Group. But there was this journey of design to UX design to product design, and now really product, but from a design perspective.
I was going to say, that's really fascinating, because I've actually got a similar journey, because I started in graphic design and digital media as well.
Yep.
And then slowly went into more human-centered UX design.
Yep.
But I guess I kind of also went into education, and it was all kind of, I don't know if it's similar, but it was all because I felt like graphic design, and it was quite limiting in terms of, and even digital media and web design and what I was doing, it was quite limiting in terms of the way, like the expectations of clients and the way things work. I wanted more in terms of human relations and more purpose in the design part that I'm doing. So I kind of went into more the education side and the human-centered design side to get that kind of purposeful design going. It sounds like that's kind of similar, like how you went into product design.
Yeah, I certainly there was never a plan, right? Like, I haven't come into my career with a plan. The only plan I had was, I'm going to be a software developer like my dad was, right? Like, I'm going to be a programmer. And a year of that was like, I don't want to be a programmer. And my dad's like, don't you want to be like a developer like me? I'm like, no, like, it was so boring. And then I'm like, design was really interesting. And so, yeah, there's some penny dropping moments for me. One of them was just the difference between art and design, where art's form is its function, and design, where form follows function. And just understanding that on a theory level, but then an application, was like, that's so refreshing. This is why I always got frustrated at the subjectivity in high school, where it was like an art teacher saying that's good and that's not. And I'm like, this sucks. Like, I dropped art, was like, no, I don't understand it. And did math, which was really logical and I understood it, and science. I didn't do very well in like English at high school. I always found that really frustrating. And then in uni, I worked out that like writing essays is just arguing. And I love arguing. I love representing something, breaking it down, debating. And so then in my design theory subjects, I would just take the case that we did and I would invert it and I would argue against it, even if I was like, you know, it was a bit of a ridiculous argument. And the lecturers loved it. He was like, thanks, this is so refreshing. Like, I read, you know, 20 essays that are all the same and yours was the opposite. And so it was so fun to read, and you still did all the right things. You looked at the right references, but you tried to build a case against it. And so that was really fun. And so I've had all these like penny dropping moments. And then, you know, in design, it was the penny dropping between the UX and just the UI, or like understanding the user needs, and then a penny dropping with understanding what real product was, and that you're actually, you know, you can't just design for the user whatever they want. That's why businesses charge money, because the business needs to make money and then serve a solution. It can't just be a free solution for customers, or the business would run out and stuff like that. So I think there's these moments, and then each time you hit those forks, it's like now you've got a new mental model. It helps build, and you can take that knowledge with you into another step or another role. And so that's what I'm doing at PaidRight, trying to take now this, I really know what design is. I know what product is. Let's try and make something awesome for payroll compliance.
Awesome. It's like all of the different things along the way, they converged into what you do now.
Yeah. There's this really interesting thing that I've been just dwelling on a lot. If you think of like neuroplasticity or how your brain works, I've often been thinking of this, like if you've got your footpath and then you've got your grass next to it, and then people start to walk and take this, we call it a path of desire, and they take it. And then the more people walk on that path, the wider it gets, and eventually you've got this new path. And I go, like, that's kind of how our brains work. And every time I get this new penny dropping moment, it's kind of like a new pathway forms, and then that pathway gets thicker as you go on it. And so who we are and how we do our jobs is how we use these pathways and eventually make these connections in our brain. And there are some that we go, well, I don't really walk on that anymore, where I was just purely design or whatever it is. And so that pathway might get really thin and not get developed. But if you walk on these paths like product and UX and UI and talking to customers and human-centered design, all of a sudden you've got this network, this really intricate way of, and that's how your brain does things. You approach a situation and it pulses through this network and you go, this is how I approach a problem, because it's how my brain is now recognizing the patterns in a situation. And I really, really like this, because that's kind of starts to explain a whole bunch of things. And when I form a new mental model, even though I can't picture it, when I've got a new mental model of how things work, it makes things click. And I really like that.
What strikes me as really unique in your approach is it's very reflective. Like, you need to analyze and figure out what's happening inside.
Yep.
I don't think many people do that.
Really? I find like that's just, yeah, I want to know why things work the way they do. And when, and that was the discovery with Aphantasia, with when it came up. And I think it was a YouTuber brought it up and said, I'm a graphic artist. And I have this thing called aphantasia, and they use the example of an apple that we've all seen before or heard before when they talk about it. And when I heard that person speaking and then she explained it, all of a sudden things made sense. And it was like a piece of the puzzle that was missing, which is like when I was in school and the teacher would be like, everyone close your eyes. Now imagine you're on a beach trying to get everyone to relax. And I'm just sitting there like, okay, we're on a beach, I guess. Like, what does that mean? What does it mean? And then finally, this new mental model drops of like, it's a spectrum. Some people can see a lot, some people cannot see anything, and most people are somewhere in the middle. I was like, now I get it. I get why that was there. I get why that happened, why you would use that exercise. And that's the same thing of like, in my career with things like workshops and how I run workshops. When I understood how you use a workshop and how you break it down into what you're trying to achieve with each activity, all of a sudden it made sense. I'm like, oh, this is a really powerful tool if used right. And if you use it wrongly, that's why everyone gets frustrated and they're like, what a waste of money that workshop was. We all met, and what did we agree on? Decide. Yeah. And so it's like having these new mental models or things clicking helps me to be better at what I do and make it life, you know,
yeah,
more fun.
Yeah. No, it's great. I feel like everyone needs to do that more. But so talk a little bit more about Aphantasia, and when did you discover that that's your experience?
So Aphantasia in general has only been around for like 2 decades. There was a guy who had brain surgery and injury, and he came out of surgery and he said to his doctor, he's like, I can't visualize stuff anymore. And the doctor's like, what do you mean? And he's like, I can't visualize my wife. And I used to be able to imagine things in my head. I can't anymore. And they're like, what do you mean? Like, no. And because he had both experiences, which is no one has. Yeah. And he went from vivid to nothing. And then they started looking at it. And there was a psychologist who started studying it, did some tests. And he was like, oh, this is interesting. And he wrote about it, or he published about it. And all of a sudden he started getting emails, like hundreds and hundreds of emails of people like, I have this, I can't picture things in my head. And he's the one that coined the term aphantasia. He took the word fantasia and got a friend that helped him. I think I might have shared that video in my post on LinkedIn the other day. But it was only, this is in 2000 and something, 2003 to 2009. So in the last 20 years, we've discovered what aphantasia was. And maybe in the last 6 years, I found out about it through some video. And I thought, oh, that's really interesting. And I started asking some other people, and I worked with a lot of creative people who were like, no, I picture all this stuff in my head. And I was like, oh, cool. And I was on pretty far on that end of the spectrum where aphantasia, or the term, really resonated with me. Mm. I was like, oh, that's why when I draw or when I do things, I tend to try to get it out on a board. I try to map it out on a virtual whiteboard, a physical whiteboard. When I draw, I found like I can't imagine realistic things. Like if I'm drawing an animal, I can't just picture that animal in my head and then kind of draw how that animal looks. I need to remember rules or remember kind of characteristics of that animal, like it has the 4 legs or a really long neck, or what is the horse's tail like? I think it's lots of hairs grouped together, and so you draw a horse's tail. So I think those types of things, the more I understood about them, the more I knew why I approached something some way, or the way that I shouldn't try to approach it another way because it just wasn't going to work. I remember a time where I'm like, I want to be better at remembering people's names and their faces. And I looked up how like those experts that can go to competitions and remember like 200 random people's names and faces. I'm like, how do I become like them? And they're like, well, the first step is you form a memory palace. You close your eyes and you have a room, often it could be your childhood home or somewhere else, and you basically hang pictures on the walls of these people, and below the people you put their name. And so that would be like, you know, here's Deanna and here's Alan and here's Josh, and you do it. And I'm sitting there with my eyes closed trying to do this, wondering why I couldn't do it. It's like, oh, okay, now it makes sense. So I'm like, there are some doorways that I feel were closed to me, but now I don't vainly pursue them, but I can actually pursue the things that my brain's structured towards and good at.
Yeah, cool. And you're a really good sketchnoter.
Is that a question?
No. it's a statement.
Okay.
It's a statement. You're okay. A very good sketchnoter. Do you feel like that has anything? Because when we first met you, you showed us all these amazing sketch notes that you do, and it wasn't for anyone but you, I think. Is that right?
Yep.
And yeah, was that, like, how did you start doing that? Was there a reason?
There wasn't a reason, right? It was very organic. That's okay. Just, there was no one that said, hey, here's a better way to do things, whether that's school or even, you know, in church growing up, and my dad's like, take notes, or like, stop playing and fiddling, just doodle. And so I'd often do drawings. So I've always liked to just scribble. I've liked to do hand typography, kind of just, you know, characters and stuff like that. But there was no real moment where I'm like, or, you know, a talk or someone else that's like, sketchnoting is a thing you should do. It was more like if there was a dozen things to write down and you can't remember them all and write fast enough, one of the things you do is you write a summary or something interesting. Or sometimes you can actually draw the concept in a better way than you could write notes about that. So it's almost like a shortcut, right? Sketchnoting in some ways is a shortcut to grab bigger concepts that would require lots of words you probably wouldn't read, to then just turn that into a simple illustration, and it gets the point and helps you remember or anchor to that moment.
In some ways, it's kind of like the mind palace on paper.
It's kind of
like a map, right?
I really think that probably is it. And it's the same as when I start to think through a workflow in a product in design, I can think through a few steps, but then as I start kind of getting into that workflow, it just all muddles up. And so as soon as you start putting notes in a digital or a physical whiteboard, you can map it out and move stuff around. That's something that I know I can't do in my head. I understand and can think through things, but I can't kind of spatially map it out. And so to get it down on paper, to get it down on a board is a tool that helps me process.
Yeah. So it does help you think through stuff. Yeah, I was wondering about that because, for example, someone on the other end of the spectrum, Alan, the way he describes his experience is whenever someone's talking, he can't really process he can't process the concepts or what's happening as easily as if he's drawing it. So if he's got a pen in his hand, then he can think more clearly. And that's because the first things that come to his mind are images. So he's got too many images in his head. So he needs to put them down on paper to make sense of them. So that's, I guess, on the other end of the spectrum. But they're both, like, both your experiences are visual thinking because you're putting things down on paper in order to process what you're thinking about.
Which makes me feel that this is maybe one of the reasons why you get a whole bunch of people that don't think they need to note take or visual. Maybe it would help them, like everyone probably should and will benefit from it. But you get this middle block of people that just kind of sit there and listen to a talk, watch a lecturer, like all of just taking in information that way is the most ineffective way anyway. Like teaching it is the most effective, or rewriting it or rephrasing it as you note take is proven effective. Mm. But I think there are some people like myself and Alan at the other end that won't learn anything or will really struggle to take away anything, remember anything, if you don't do that. Like it's almost like you have to. I remember hearing about a link between dyslexia and hyperphantasia from a research paper or something. And I had a colleague whose son was very artistic, and also I knew that her son was dyslexic, and I asked her, like, hey, what's going on in your son's head? Like, is it like, and then she asked him, she's like, I don't know. And she asked him, and complete visual cacophony. Like, and so there is this link between words become three-dimensional and really visual and get jumbled up. And so there is this, you know, they haven't studied it enough yet, but that I found that fascinating. And so I could understand why him listening to a teacher would also be really, really tough. Like, he would need to kind of get it out or do something. And for the same for me, like I also get distracted. I'll also start kind of thinking about other things. Just my mind can't grab onto that. Maybe that's another part of neurodivergence we can talk about another time. But writing helps me kind of concentrate and follow a thread.
That's really interesting. Actually, Alan, when he's trying to describe his experience, I've heard him say a lot of times, like, it's not dyslexia, but it was kind of like dyslexia, like his experience as a kid.
Yep.
Like he would just not be able to, process the words. He'd probably be able to say it better maybe during the panel. But he describes it as something like dyslexia. So that's very interesting.
Whereas I'm the opposite on that end. I would look at a whiteboard or a chalkboard back then, right? And the teacher would have words up there. And I'd go to write stuff down. And every word I would have to look up again to get the word because I couldn't hold what was on the whiteboard in my head and all other things going on in my head, like thoughts and stuff. And I couldn't. And so that's an executive function to do with memory and attention span and prefrontal cortex and all this stuff. But I just remember that just didn't click. It was just like, oh yeah, like I just was distracted and teachers would be like, oh, Josh doesn't listen or like, you know, but it was how my brain worked and it couldn't grasp hold of that on the whiteboard. So I'd, every word I'd be looking up to write down or maybe get two or three. And that's another reason why, like, being able to grab the concept off the board and then draw the concept was easier than trying to like for like copy information because I couldn't hold on to that in the same way. But if I could get a concept, you could draw it rather than, you know, if it was this Voyager traveled on the ship and in this year or something like that, I'd lose it all. But if I could draw a picture of a ship and the ocean and then write the year 1940 or whatever, like all of a sudden makes sense.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. My experience is actually, I love listening to audiobooks and podcasts and talks. It actually makes me calm, like if I'm overwhelmed. And I don't know what that means, but I feel like I can process, like if I'm listening to it, I just process the information really easily. Not that my memory is good or I can remember it later.
Yep.
very well, but it just, yeah, it kind of feels like it helps me focus. So I don't know, maybe I'm an auditory learner or something, but yeah, very, very interesting how it's lots of different experiences. I wanted to ask you, you said in class you'd be distracted and mm-hmm. maybe with lots of thoughts and things like that. Do you think there's, I don't know what I'm asking actually. Are the thoughts to do with what's happening at all? Or is it more like, do you feel like you're processing things in a different way in parallel with someone who is like, when they're listening, they can see like a visual scene, for example? Is there a different way in parallel that you process things?
It's an interesting question. I could be so wrong with my mental model, and it keeps changing of how all of this stuff works. But again, like, I apply things through the mental model I have of how my brain works today. And then maybe in 6 months, there's more research and I go, oh, like, that's a better way to view it. But if you look at neurodivergence, which is just a general spectrum of processes in your prefrontal cortex and your ability to deal with the information that comes in, one type in particular of ADHD will be that you just can't process all of the signals coming in and you can't filter, right? So if the teacher's talking about this and you're coming in, most neurotypical people can focus on that thread and keep following it. When neurodivergence comes in is you can't process that information and focus all these other signals coming in, and they just overwhelm. All of us, the reason it's a spectrum is we all have this to a degree, same as if you're in a conversation with a friend and they mention something and you want to quickly talk about that other thing.
Yeah.
Because it's relevant, it's sparked. And I find that coming back to this model of, because I'm the same as you, I love audiobooks, I love podcasts. I don't necessarily really picture things when I listen to an audiobook, but I can follow stories and understand characters and stuff. But it's this mental model of patterns or pathways in your brain that get triggered by things. And so I find that in school, in general, I can listen to stuff, but when it triggers a pathway that's really interesting, my brain wants to follow that pathway. Mm-hmm. And I think of that, which is a superpower in product, in design, because you can now, if you've got this fundamental understanding of how product works, of how strategy of design, then when you listen to customer interviews or you talk to the business or you look at the product, you can now apply that kind of model or framework and go, no, here's what needs to change. Here's where we need to go. Here's the pathway. And pathways become obvious. So it's really a superpower in that sense. Mm. But in another sense, when you're listening to lecturers or talks, unless you're doing something to try to keep you on that thread, it's everything that's related, adjacent. It could be the person over there that's coughing. It could be the light flickering. It's just other things come in, and whatever's louder just tends to take you in that. If you're really passionate like me about stuff, then the things you're passionate about become all consuming and you follow them. So when it's design or when it's photography or stationery or coffee or all of my sorts of hobbies, you like pursue them, and then, you know, whatever's related to them triggers and fires off when you're listening.
Awesome. And one last question.
Sure.
How do you recall things? So we talked about processing things, but is there a specific way that you recall things? So I was talking to Ben Pekatic, who also has aphantasia, but seems like a slightly different experience. And he's like, you know, I don't draw at all. And the way he documents things is and processes things is by taking lots and lots of photos. So he's got, and like he loves like organizing documents and things. So is there a way that you use to recall things?
I don't think I have a method like as structured as Ben does. I know that there are so many times where I'm like, what is that thing? And it was important and it's just gone. So I have things like a personal Notion that I store like links or articles in, that when they trigger and they go, that's really cool, I try to remember to save it into a database in Notion so that I have it, because I lose that.
But actually, Ben, when I was talking to him, he was talking about recalling things in a way, like in his mind, that's not visual, but it's more like coordinates or data.
Yep.
And yeah, I'm interested in that. Like, what's your experience in when you're trying to recall? You say, for example, if you recall your wife and kids' faces,
yep.
you can't see anything.
Yep.
is there another way to recall them?
Yeah, so I did this. I'd never put the full drawing on. It's the little post that I did the other day on LinkedIn. Oh, yeah. If I said I just draw a basic head, I don't know. And I said, like, if this is like your visual cortex from, I think it's your hippocampus and your, anyway, if this is what I call like your mind's eye, my almost feeling or the way I describe how I think through things is almost like it happens in backstage, right? Like, I can't see things. I also don't have the ability to create sounds in my head, which was another light bulb moment for me, which is like, I hear friends that harmonize and they can hear the harmony before they sing it or something, and then they can do it. And I'm like, how do you do that? The only way I could ever sing a harmony is if I learned the harmony, right? If I over and over again, or if there's a person next to me singing the harmony, I could sing a harmony with them. But I couldn't hear a harmony in my head because I can't. So where
can
I just...
Can you hear a tune that you've heard?
No.
Okay.
I could walk through the lyrics and kind of, if there's a bit of a song, I have to almost start from the bit I know and just keep working through the lyrics. But I don't actually hear the song.
Yep.
I can't really hear it. I just kind of follow the pattern. But so I get nothing happening in this stage. And almost if I try to, it's kind of like your peripheral vision that, like, you know, something might happen outside here, but you can't focus on it. It's, to me, that's what my brain feels like, right? Like that I just can't create the thing I want, but it feels like it's almost there. It's around the back. It's so I think through thoughts and I can't obviously picture words, but words and thoughts and arguments and conversations with myself that aren't audible, they're just like, I don't know how you describe it, as thoughts that happen backstage, and it's only what comes through my eyes that appears there. Mm-hmm. But like I think most people with aphantasia, you still can at times have dreams and other things that are very visual. I don't much anymore, but I remember vividly from as a child having lots of dreams. So your brain still can recreate the visuals, but mine just can't at will, and I don't when I'm thinking through stuff. Have that. So yeah, lots of thoughts. If I imagine my wife and my kids, I can't picture them. I have to think about what I want to know about them, right? Like if you're like, oh, you're drawing a photo of my youngest daughter, like I've got some comics somewhere on Instagram, but I know that my youngest daughter has like wavy hair, right? She's got like wavy blonde hair. So when I draw her, I'll go like exceptionally wavy with her hair. And I know she's really, really cheeky. So I might draw like a super cheeky grin for her with like something like that, right? And then because I don't know how to draw eyes, I'll just draw like a face like that. And that's how I draw Grace, and that's how I think about Grace, because I know these attributes. I can't picture in my head. I know she's a kid, so therefore when you draw kids, I know that you don't draw much of a neck. The longer the neck is, the older a character looks. Again, a rule, a thing I learned. Like if I draw a longer neck with her and then t-shirt or something, it makes her all of a sudden look more like an adult. And so I know these rules, but in my head, I don't know Grace. Like I can't picture her. But there's never a doubt that I see her in a photo, I see her in real life. Like immediately my brain, because of the backstage and all the processes, goes, yeah, that's my daughter.
Cool. Yeah, so you've created a framework for how to draw it. Yeah.
Yeah, when I was a kid, my mum took me to drawing lessons. I really struggled with a lot of the real things, but the one that I gravitated to was cartoons. And there was a cartooning section of the drawing class. And they taught us how to draw like eyes and noses. And then like, I'm like, I really like this. It's like shortcuts to drawing what you want, and you can exaggerate things. I don't put it into practice much. So I find like most of it has kind of gone by the wayside over the years, but still like little cute eyes and simple mouths with big expressions tend to be much easier for me to draw than something real.
It's actually quite similar to how we teach introduction to sketchnoting, because we basically tell people it's not really about creating a masterpiece, it's just about communicating. And you were at our workshop, so yep. it's basically trying to convince everyone that they can just hold a piece of pen and paper and just draw something that communicates what they're trying to say. And it's usually through, like, you know, there are rules that you can use to just break down anything and draw it. So it sounds very similar.
Alan at that exercise drew this like simple silhouette of a person, right? Like this or something. And I found that a really useful way. Like I didn't have a way to do the body, but that means you can obviously get like all these different expressions with the body stretching or leaning or standing upright. I was like, oh, that's a really helpful shortcut. And so I like those shortcuts. And same with this mouth with the little zigzaggy teeth. Like to me, that was a way to draw that grin. And I was like, oh, cool. So I kind of almost remembered and cataloged that of like, okay, what's that rule? And I'm like, you draw zigzaggy. Oh, yeah, cool.
Yeah. Yeah, awesome. Cool. Well, I don't think we had a chance to talk much about how you use visual thinking in your work at the moment, but you did talk a lot about, you know, frameworks and models that you use. Is there any tips that you have to someone who is in the design industry,
mm-hmm.
As to how to make use of the superpower of visual thinking?
Great question. I think you have to, you know, put it in production, put a link to it in a post.
Yeah, well,
there's that comic by, I think it's Jeff Payton. It's like this. And it's got three people, and they're like, I'm glad we all agree. And inside their heads, they've got these thought bubbles, and one's got like a triangle, one's got a square, and one's got a circle, right? And they say, I'm glad we all agree, and in their heads, they've got this different thought.
Yep.
And then the next one is, I think, them with like a chalkboard in front of them, and they've drawn the circle, the square, and the triangle. And then then all three of them are like, oh, like that, I think it says, oh. And they don't all agree. In their heads, they had a different picture. And whether you're like Alan and you've got lots of visuals happening, but I think that's what I mean about mental models of situations. Regardless if you can picture it or not, we all develop an understanding. Our brain forms a pathway and says, this is what it is. And then the third panel, I think, is them working together until they get this like spiky star shape. And they do. And then the last panel ends with these, like, I'm glad we all agree. And in their heads, they've all got the same shape. To me, that is a summary. That is 101 why you need this skill, 101 why you should be doing this. It's not always visual, but I find that whether it's a map or relationship diagrams, it connects these thoughts together. I think having a toolbox, developing a toolbox of ways to get things on the same page, whether that is something pretty unique or whether that's prototyping or whether that's just getting people to learn how to draw. There's a really cool exercise called Draw Toast, and I've used it quite a few times, where you ask a group of people, draw how you make toast. I want you to draw toast. That's basically the instruction you give them. You give them a piece of paper and say, draw toast. And I've done this with like 20 people. I've done it with like 5 people. It works for everyone. And everyone does something similar. They draw something. And then they usually draw something like a line, or maybe they draw like panels, like a comic book, and then they'll draw the next thing. And so they've got these relationships they immediately put on the page with like nodes and connecting lines. And then if you get them to do it like now, you give them all post-it notes and you say, now I want you to draw a toast, but on your post-it notes, and then you get them to group those post-it notes, people start to get this visual diagram and similar things. Some people said you've got to go buy bread from the shops and get it out of the bread bag and put it in a toaster. And then if you do this in Europe or in other countries, people have different ways of making toast, which is also quite fun to do. But it teaches people this relationship between steps and nodes and flows. And then you can do stuff, and I've used this in design so many times, where you go, now draw sign up. And you get people to do the same thing, and all of a sudden, or draw our sales process. And you go, well, then there's so-and-so who speaks with the customer and does this, and people go, no, draw it. And they draw these steps. And all of a sudden, you can start to see how other people imagine, or, oh, a really good example that came up is we had two companies merging together and we met and I said, draw how you get a product published on the marketplace. And one company and the other company had very different ways of doing it. And we were merging together. So we wanted to get the out in the air how we think it should get in the marketplace. And it was this funny, if you had a line from start to it's published on the marketplace and gets a sale, where it transitioned from one company to the other company varied. One company thought they did 80% of it, and the other company thought they did 80% of it. And so we were able to then get that visual out. So I think different activities that can get you all to represent what's happening in your head, whether that's notes and writing can help, but I really think just the most basic visuals are more powerful than just writing the words, because the words still leave that subjectivity, whereas a picture can be a little bit more objective with, okay, like they're meeting in person, they're handing over a document, stuff like that.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Well, design is all about collaboration and, you know, the collective kind of innovation, and communication is a big part of it. So you have to get things out of your head and onto paper so that everyone can agree on it. So
yeah,
awesome. Great. Well, thank you so much for joining me today.
That's all right. Thanks for having me.
And yeah, I look forward to our Think Visual panel.
That'd be exciting. I'm looking forward to it too, to hear particularly from another person in a similar industry with aphantasia, and then also to hear from Alan, who has a particularly different way of viewing the world, which is cool.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it as well. Anywhere you want people to follow you or connect with you if they have any questions?
Just LinkedIn is going to be the best place from a professional sense. And I don't have a personal website or anything. So.
Awesome.
Cool. Right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Great.